Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to ask a pharmacist about getting naloxone for their first aid kits at home or work. No prescription is needed. Naloxone can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose and restore breathing. Opioidresponse.info.
And so we move into the final week of February. It's Monday, February 22nd, and I don't know about how you're feeling about the time out there, but on one hand, in the midst of the pandemic, time seems to be stuck in place. It seems like day to day we're not moving forward at all. On the other hand, the calendar, from my point of view, keeps flying by. It'll be March in a week, and that kind of astonishes me. It means, of course, also that in just a couple of weeks, we will be up against a truly stunning anniversary, basically 1 year. March 16th of last year was basically the date that things really shut down across the country. And we're only a couple of weeks away from the 1 year anniversary of that. We have an awful lot to talk about on Political Rewind today. But I'd like to start just making mention of another troubling moment in our history. And I'm going to read it, a report, directly from the New York Times, a couple of paragraphs of a piece that they ran yesterday. A nation numbed by misery and loss is confronting a number that still has the power to shock, 500,000. Roughly 1 year since the first known death by the coronavirus in the United States, an unfathomable toll has arrived, actually, now, the loss of 500,000 people. No other country has counted so many deaths in the pandemic. More Americans have perished from COVID-19 than on the battlefields of World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. But the milestone comes at a hopeful moment. New virus cases are down sharply. Deaths are slowing, and vaccines are steadily being administered, even as there's new concern about emerging variants of the virus, and it now may be months before the pandemic is contained. Here in Georgia, we're now at almost 805,000 people infected with COVID-19. 14,633 people have died from the disease. Georgia has now, this governor late last week announced that he has opened up four locations, or about to open four locations across the state where people can be vaccinated, up in Habersham County at the fairgrounds in Clarksville, at the Macon State Farmers Market, at the Albany Forestry Commission offices in Albany, and then at the Delta Flight Museum on the southwest side of Atlanta, just into Clayton County. But the governor's office also released a news release the other day saying that while people seem to be really eager to get vaccinated in three of those four locations, it's saying that in Daugherty County in Albany, people are not registering. There's now a site where you can register statewide in hopes of getting a vaccine, and registrations are lagging dramatically, the governor's office says, in Daugherty County. Amelia Brock, I wonder, I'll send you a link. Maybe we can put up a link to myvaccinationgeorgia.com that people can use if they want to register for a vaccine. And meanwhile, in DeKalb County, the AJC reports this morning that Dr. Sandra Ford, public health officials along with her, are saying people are desperate to find a way to get vaccinated. So the continuation on the vaccine front continues to be very troubling here in the state of Georgia. I want to talk a little bit about that during the show today, and let me first get our panel introduced. It's Monday, which means Jim Galloway, the legend of Georgia political analysis, is back with us. He may have retired from the AJC, but we are never going to allow him to retire from Political Rewind. Jim, it's just chilling to think about what this virus has done to our lives and led to the deaths of so many people here in the state and across the country.
Yeah, I mean, if you live in Georgia, you know of someone who has struggled with the virus or who has died from it. I mean, the footprint is amazing, and I had my own little experience with it last week. I was geared up for a shot at 1 p.m. today to get my second Moderna shot. And I got a text and an email from the Cobb Douglas Public Health Department that said, no, we're going to have to postpone that because the weather that swept across the nation kind of it literally froze transportation in Memphis and Kentucky. So even as we're opening these huge, massive vaccination centers, there's just not enough of the stuff to go around.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear about your experience. It's one shared by many, many people. And the State Department of Public Health does say they're expecting a big supply of vaccine later this week. So I hope you and the many people in your situation will get those shots. We're also very happy to be welcomed today, welcoming back to the show Representative Sam Park, Democrat from Lawrenceville. Sam Park, what are your constituents saying to you about coronavirus and about getting the vaccine? How urgent are their concerns about those issues?
Good morning, Bill. Happy to be with you again. So there's a lot of demand in Gwinnett County for the coronavirus vaccine still. I've had constituents reach out expressing a lot of concern and frustration about how many hours they've had to spend given how quickly the slots fill up. Hopefully, as the Biden administration increases the supply of vaccines that Georgia receives, we'll see some of those challenges ameliorated. But of course, the disproportionate distribution of vaccines where minority communities, particularly Black and Brown communities, aren't being vaccinated remains concerning.
Yeah, down in Savannah, the legislators from Savannah and the Savannah Health largest health provider are all saying, please get vaccine to our minority communities. They really need it desperately. And of course, that's something that people across the state, public health officials are starting to look more realistically at trying to do. I'm glad you mentioned that. Riley Bunch is with us. She, of course, is the Georgia State House reporter for CNHI News, which means she reports for a number of newspapers in somewhat smaller markets around the state. Riley, you're in the middle of your second session, you told us, of the Georgia General Assembly. How does it feel down there at the Capitol these days?
You know, it's a pretty weird environment. The halls aren't really bustling as much as usual. And it's strange to think, you know, we're coming up on this year of the first two cases in Georgia, COVID cases in Georgia being announced by Governor Brian Kemp. I remember the press conference we had in his ceremonial office, and there were 40 press members crammed in there without masks. You know, just think of how far we've come and how weird of a time it is right now compared to a year ago.
We're also joined today by someone who is a longtime political insider here in Georgia, who could certainly tell Riley Bunch that it's always a little weird down at the Georgia State Capitol, regardless of whether there's a pandemic or not. That's Republican strategist Heath Garrett. How you doing, Heath?
Bill, it's great to be with you, and you're exactly right. Every year is a new level of weirdness in the state legislature.
All right. Well, I want to talk about one of the issues down there that has, from the very beginning, from late last year, when legislators began talking about bills they plan to introduce that were going to change how Georgians vote, primarily by absentee voting, but also early voting changes, that has continued to be, I think it's safe to say, the single most controversial issue at the Capitol this year. And I want to get all of you to weigh in on this. But Jim, let me just quickly start with you on this. Republicans in the House are preparing this week. They've kind of consolidated a bill into one large bill, 48-page bill, a number of the changes they want to make. We've talked about some of them on the show before. There have been photo ID for absentee ballot applications. There's a bill that would require photo ID for the application as well as when you actually vote. So we've talked about that. Some in the Senate want to end absentee no-excuse balloting, although that's probably not going to get very far in the House. But I want to start, if I can, Jim, with one that is new, at least on my radar screen, and that's this 48-page bill includes a measure to end Sunday early voting and to limit Saturday early voting to only one Saturday, right?
Right, right. And it also limits the puts a hard limit on the time allowed for issuing absentee ballots and delivering them to voters and for voters to mail them in. One of the other provisions, I think, and Riley can correct me if I'm wrong, is that it would bar county election offices from accepting grants from outside from third party sources that allowed them to that allowed them last year to really bump up the number of electoral poll workers that they had. And this was a program that was instituted and encouraged by Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican. Now I've been thinking of this about this quite a bit, and you can draw the parallels to what Democrats did in 2001 to protect as they saw their majority shrinking, but this is beginning. But just the regional nature of this isn't happening just in Georgia. It's happening in many states across the country. In many ways, this is becoming to resemble the massive resistance movements that we saw in the South during the 1950s, when the U.S. Supreme Court was starting to engage on school segregation. This time the fight is over how or whether we will accept these demographic changes that are occurring in every state in the nation.
Riley, and then I want to get Sam and Heath in on this. One of the reasons that Sunday early voting, a barring of Sunday early voting, struck me particularly is, of course, that's always been the souls on the polls day. That's a day in which black churches across the state have rallied their congregants and people in their community to go to the polls and cast early ballots. And I would love, maybe Heath has been in touch with some of the Republicans who are supporting that, but I would love to know what the rationale is behind why that no longer, I mean, are we not trying to encourage as many people as possible to get to the polls, Riley?
Well, absolutely. And I think it's kind of indicative, you know, just looking from the outside in, of Republicans know that their ground game efforts were, you know, lacking compared to Democrats. There are a number of provisions in the bill that kind of impact these very large, widespread Democratic mobilization efforts, so, you know, like those to the polls, like mobile voting units. So it's kind of not surprising to see that these things, you know, the Sunday voting has been done, kind of proposed to be done away with, but it will impact, you know, disproportionately minority voters, faith leaders trying to get their communities out, and it's a big concern for voting advocates.
Heath, and then Sam, why don't you, Heath, you go ahead, and then Sam, I'd love to have you weigh in.
Yeah, Bill, I think, look, going back to Jim's historical perspective, I think that election integrity and suppression debates are now much more like gerrymandering than they are like the 1960s. And I know that one side of the aisle would like to say this is all about suppression, but you're giving people a minimum of 3 weeks and multiple ways to vote absentee ballots. So it's not like we're going back to one day voting between 8 and 8, and it's really difficult to vote or register to vote in the state of Georgia. So let's set the baseline there. We're now, like gerrymandering has become hyperpartisan. Both sides, anytime there's a change to election laws, the left and my Democratic friends are going to always yell suppression because there's one person who it's more convenient to vote at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night than it is for somebody else. However, we as Republicans have to be smart and recognize that that is a political reality that we're dealing with. And that, you know, just because both sides are getting partisan about how and when we're going to do elections and how we're going to vote, you know, my Republican colleagues need to be smart about this. The suppression myth, according to some people, and the suppression concern, which is legitimate among some people, I think, you know, is a political reality we got to face. But we're not talking about dramatic changes here, I think, in the number of opportunities to vote. And I think at the end of the day, the bill, you'll see bill coming out of the legislature, won't have some of these things. The one fundamental point that I think my Republican brothers and sisters are doing in the legislature, they're trying to create uniformity amongst the counties. We had a election in November, and again in January, we had different hours available in different counties. Your availability to get to early voting is different in rural areas. And so that's the one principle I think they can stand on, is creating some uniformity around these county voting, so that no matter where you live in Georgia, you have the same opportunity to vote in person and by absentee ballot.
Sam, Democrats obviously are fighting furiously against many of these measures.
So, House Bill 531 and these Republican efforts to make it more difficult for Georgians to vote is incredibly, incredibly concerning and undemocratic. I think context is always important. And I've heard from many Republican colleagues that, you know, we have to pass these measures because millions of Americans continue to have concerns about election integrity and security. Well, I think it's important to note that millions of Americans may still believe that because of the lie that Trump spouted, that there was widespread election fraud and that the election was stolen. If Secretary Raffensperger, if national security experts said that there was no widespread fraud, that these were some of the most secure elections that were conducted in modern history, how can we then reasonably justify efforts to make it more difficult for citizens to vote? Not only do I think that's undemocratic, I think that's un-American. And again, it's incredibly, incredibly concerning that they are trying to continue to push these issues that would particularly disproportionately make it harder for working people and for people of color to participate in our democracy. When it comes to uniformity, I think, sure, we can find some common ground, but we also have to acknowledge the reality that in metro Atlanta counties, there's a lot. Population is much dense, and we have to ensure that we provide our local election offices the resources and ability to ensure that, again, every citizen can participate in our democratic process.
You know, Heath, I'd like to pick up on what you said. Galloway's comparison is very, very dramatic, obviously, saying this reminds him of what happened across the South, in Georgia included, of course, after the courts and Congress started ruling on equal rights for African Americans and how whites in the South tried to push back against some of those changes. That's pretty dramatic. You compare it to gerrymandering. So let's use your comparison, and I'd like to get a sense of this from all of you. Heath, we know clearly that partisan gerrymandering is, whether it's Democrats under Roy Barnes or Republicans who will deal with redistricting under a Republican Governor Brian Kemp, the lines are drawn for partisan advantage. They are drawn to get as many of your own party into power, into offices, whether it's Congress, legislature, as possible. When you compare these voting bills to partisan gerrymandering, are you suggesting, again, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, that these bills are being introduced to either expand or contract the number of people who are going to vote for the other side in a given election?
Well, and let me be clear to the listeners. I'm not saying that I agree with any of this, but I think that's what is a closer analogy to. Yes, there's no question that Stacey Abrams and her efforts around voter suppression are driven by political motives, right? Every political consultant knows that the number one motivator for an African-American voter in the state of Georgia is the fear of suppression. And so she built Fair Fight and its entire apparatus around the political knowledge that if she can kind of push the suppression narrative, that she can change election laws in a way that benefit Democrats. And so the idea that the Republicans, there's not going to be an equal and opposite reaction on that. Both sides need to be very careful with this. I have a problem with the fair fight suppression myth, as I call it, because fair fight has lost every single legal case brought since 2018, and the AJC can't find a single voter that was denied the right to vote in 2018 or 2020. We've had record participation. At the same point in time, Trump and team have followed the Stacey Abrams playbook and created a myth of integrity problems in Georgia that don't exist either. And so what I say is the pot's on both partisan hats, and I think that's where they're going with election law, and I think both sides are engaged in it. If my Democratic friends were as interested in poor rural white people voting as they were in urban minority poor, then they would have, a better leg to stand on this, and vice versa. We Republicans ought to be making it as easy to vote as possible in the urban areas.
Okay, I do want to make one correction, I think, to what you said, and that is, I think, the biggest case that Fair Fight has, where they've rolled together many of their concerns about how the election of 2018 unfolded, is now, in fact, moving forward in federal court. There is, in fact, a big, big case, Jim, aren't I right, that's still going to be heard in federal court.
Yeah, it's been slimmed down, but it's still very active. Okay. And there were very many. There were quite a few rulings in 2018 by judges across the state in response to Fair Fight lawsuits challenging this matter or that matter. I think Sam can talk. I think there was a big effort in Gwinnett County that Sam could speak to.
I know there was a lot of concern when it came to the way in which they were when it comes to voter registration. I think it was the exact match system mm-hmm. policy that they had in place, which again disproportionately made it more difficult for people of color to register to vote. But I want to address real quickly, if I may, the so-called myth of voter suppression. Voter suppression is not a myth. In fact, Georgia's had, and this country has had, a long history of voter suppression going to Jim Crow, where you made it more difficult for people to vote. And we are seeing a modern-day version of these nefarious, subtle ways, again, to make it more difficult to vote. You know, one of the best ways, I think, in which we can make it easier for urban folks as well as rural folks to vote is send out absentee applications to everyone, just as I think Oregon, some Republican and Democratic states on the West Coast.
So I'm going to take Heath's point. I want to say, let's give Heath for the moment the point that there's no question that Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight action has been accusing Republicans of voter suppression, certainly since the 2018 election cycle, and there's still adjudication to come out of their accusations. But Raleigh, I want to go to the other side of that again. Certainly one of the things you can say about what Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight organization initially was launched to do, and we're going to talk in a few minutes about Kelly Loeffler looking to do something quite similar on the Republican side of the aisle, Fair Fight was initially all about increasing the number of people who could vote in the state. Now, clearly, they were focusing on populations that they assumed would be more likely to vote Democratic than Republican. But it's one thing to talk suppression. It's another thing to talk about efforts to expand voting. And this is where I kind of have this concern about if that becomes partisan. The question of expanding voting becomes partisan, then maybe Sam Park has an awfully good point when he says that feels anti-democratic.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely hard to reconcile all these changes, you know, that are being offered up, even small to big, after such a high turnout election, right? You know, we had record number of in-person voters. We had record number of absentee ballots used. So it's like I said, hard to reconcile making changes to a system that seemingly worked this year. And, you know, there was this huge movement to expand voters. But I think if Republicans are successful in this, I think that they're going to have to explain, you know, really well why they are making these changes on the first day of legislative session there were voters out on the steps concerned about what changes would come later in the session. You know, it's hard, you know, to explain these changes after such a successful election amid a pandemic.
So, Heath, you believe there's going to be, I think, a good deal of compromise. You essentially said that in your first comments about this 48-page bill that's been presented for the House. And I'll give you an example of what I'm interested in thinking about here. I said on our show last week that when the last time David Ralston was on our show was before the 2020 November election. I think, Galloway, you were with me that day. And Ralston at that point was expressing his concern about the expansion of absentee balloting. He was one of the people in the camp of saying he thought it opened the door for substantial fraud. And yet, Heath, he seems to have backed away from that now that the session is underway, because it's my understanding that Ralston does not support the bill that senators want to get through, which is to end no excuse absentee balloting. So there is room for some of this to be clawed back in compromises, it appears, Heath. And then, Sam, I'd love your take on that.
No, I think that's right. I think we need to be clear about a few things. First of all, nobody is talking about anything in regards to voter registration or dramatically limiting anybody's ability to vote. Remember, Georgia's it's not necessarily the easiest state in the country, but it's one of the top five easiest states in the country to both register to vote. You can do it online. Governor Kemp, when he was Secretary of State, made that possible, made it the number one state to register online in the country. It's still and Stacey Abrams took advantage of that. And I've said on this show 100 times, it's all due respect to her organization's ability to get out and get her voters registered. She's allowed to do that. So nobody is talking about doing anything to take away anybody's registration to vote. And I'll say to Sam's statement, I agree wholeheartedly. As somebody who grew up in post-desegregated, I know the history of the South, but the history of the South 40 and 50 years ago should not be compared to what's been happening in modern-day Georgia, and I think that's a real negative for us. And I'd finally say there is going to be room for compromise. I think the Speaker and the Governor really want the election legislation to focus on those things that go straight to security and into integrity, and not to necessarily ease of voting and these other efforts.
So we had a big debate in the Georgia State Legislature a year or two ago about the way in which we would be conducting our elections. And over and over and over again, we shared a report from the National Academy of Sciences and Engineering, which was saying that hand-marked paper ballots is a gold standard for election integrity. And yet every single Republican voted to move forward with these Dominion voting machines, which there still seems to be a lot of concern about. And so if we want to talk about election integrity, then let's use science, let's use facts in order to move that issue forward. When it comes to compromising on a bill like 531, any effort to make it more difficult to vote is a non-starter, at least from my personal perspective. I think it's, again, unacceptable, it is undemocratic, and it is unjustified. And if I could add one more point to all of this, I don't think folks are turning out to vote. I don't think we saw massive turnout during the 2020 elections because of the narrative of voter suppression. Folks turned out because they wanted change. They wanted effective government. They wanted a government that would do something about the pandemic. And I think folks in Georgia, they want government that works for them when it comes to health care. We have one of the highest uninsured rates in the country. Education remains to be underfunded. And so I would push back on that idea. And ultimately, I think the objectives of Fair Fight is noble, which is to have a fair fight in which policy debates, candidates with the best ideas, can ultimately prevail.
Jim, I want to give you a quick comment before we got to get to a break.
Okay, and actually, I was just going to hit up Riley for a point of information. I mean, does this 48-page bill, does it end automatic voter registration at the DMV?
Not that I have seen or read, but that would be something
that's another legislation then.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to point that out too, Jim. There is, in fact, a measure that would end automatic voter registration at DMV, and we'll see if that tracks forward along with this big comprehensive bill that the House is now going to look at apparently this week. All right, we've got to get to a break. I want to get that out of the way and come back with a lot more on Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're joined today by Jim Galloway, Riley Bunch, Heath Garrett, and Representative Sam Park of Gwinnett County. You know, Galloway, I remember we're old enough, and so is Garrett. I don't. Riley and Sam are both still young in the political world. We're old enough. We kind of remember when there were seasons to political campaigns. You know, an election would come to an end. There would be a break for a while before people began talking about running for the next election cycle. We'd normally be in one of those breaks if times were what they were, Galloway, but they're not. The elections never stop. We already know that David Perdue's team has at least saved a place for him by filing legal papers should he decide he wants to challenge Raphael Warnock in 2022. And now Kelly Loeffler has announced that she is creating an organization modeled in many ways, I think, after what Stacey Abrams did with Fair Fight to try to expand voter registrations among Republicans, which many people assume is her first move in thinking about launching another campaign as well, Jim.
Right, right. It's Greater Georgia, I think, is the name of the organization. Mm-hmm. And in an interview that my former colleague, Greg Bluestein, just published, Loeffler said, yes, indeed, she is contemplating a race against a 2022 race against Raphael Warnock, who beat her on January 5. So I think that has more possibility than David Perdue. But the concept of Loeffler as kind of a voting rights specialist, it has a huge hurdle, just given the fact that when that Texas challenge to Georgia's election results came through, she signed on to it. She and David Perdue signed on to it. So both Loeffler and Perdue will have to explain to 5 million Georgia voters why they didn't want those votes to count. That's a pretty big dilemma.
Heath, I'm curious from, go ahead. You make whatever comment you want, and I've got a couple questions for you.
Well, no, and I agree with Jim. I mean, I think Greg Bluestein nailed it. She's a complicated messenger at best in this effort. There's no doubt that we as Republicans need an effort like this to counter the success that I respect from what Abrams and Fair Fight have done from a purely political standpoint in organizing and voting. Since the 2012 election, where Romney barely won the state of Georgia, there's been this kind of idea that there are these 400,000 to 600,000 Republican-leaning rural voters that just haven't registered or participated for whatever reason, and that if we could just get those registered, I'm not sure that's the best use of all resources for the Republican Party when there are millions of votes in the suburbs and the urban area that we are also gettable for us as Republicans. But look, I think Kelly's an interesting figure. I think it's frustrating for those of us who watched, and I think it's difficult for her to be talking about election integrity when she did join in this kind of integrity issue. And look, she either got bad information from her consultants or she herself believes that there was this fraud, either which aren't a great scenario for the future of the Republican Party in Georgia. And I just think she's a damaged candidate in so many ways. So her money's going to be welcome and she can clearly fund this, but hopefully she's going to get better advice than what she had in that losing election.
Riley, of course, one of the things that all of us in who watch these elections as journalists saw, and Republicans and Democrats both watched it as well, is that it was the Doug Collins challenge of Kelly Loeffler in that jungle election, which essentially would have weakened either of them, in her case, weakened Kelly Loeffler. And then, of course, Donald Trump added to that by focusing on the so-called rigged election in Georgia. Doug Collins may very well get into this race, in which case we're once again going to look at a Republican Party fighting among itself and maybe weakening whoever comes out of the race, Riley.
Yeah, well, you know, this announcement of former Senator Loeffler's new organization wasn't a surprise to me. We knew in those races that it was going to be all about turning out the base. And they had so many issues with turning out their base in terms of former President Donald Trump, saying not to use absentee ballots and having all the kind of the inner fighting in between candidates. And as of right now, we heard from Doug Collins too in the AJC just recently. He's not ruling out a run for the Senate or the governor at all. So it seems kind of, they may not have learned their lesson of having all these different candidates throw their hat into the ring. Maybe it'll be different this time, but I could see definitely some challenges with the party again if they have all these different candidates trying to get in.
Sam Park, one way or the other, Raphael Warnock's going to be a big target next year as he attempts to secure that seat for a full 6-year term.
Yes, I look forward to doing everything I can to reelect Senator Warnock, who I greatly admire, just not just in terms of his story and where he came from, where he demonstrates the possibility of what this country, the opportunity that this country can provide, but the work that he's been doing, from expanding access to healthcare, the right to vote, so on and so forth. If I may, Bill, I do look forward to the day in which we could perhaps go back to the time in which we aren't in a constant political election season, personally.
Yeah, but you would know as well as anyone having to run for re-election once you've been elected for a 2-year term, I think, right?
Right.
Okay, Jim.
If I could jump in and build on something that Heath just said, the supposition that there are hundreds of thousands of white rural voters in Georgia who aren't activated. The problem with that, this has been the Purdue strategy, whether it's Sonny or David or Donald Trump. That's how you carry Georgia. The problem is the message that you need to activate those white rural voters the message Republicans have used so far has been very hard, just borderline racist. And when in going after those voters, you lose your advantage in the suburbs. You cut those people loose. To pick up on Heath's arithmetic, you're chasing hundreds of thousands of voters, and you're losing millions in Metro Atlanta.
Jim, you're spot on. One of the quants, as I call them, the data guys who was down here working for David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler in the runoff, said for every one voter that Donald Trump, Kelly, and David were motivating in rural Georgia, we were losing 1.2 voters in suburban Atlanta, right? And you do that over the course of hundreds of thousands or millions of votes, and guess what? You lose an election. And so, the old saying, why do you rob a bank? Because that's where the money is, right? Republicans have to run base plus campaigns. Democrats did a great job of that in 2020. We've just got Raphael Warnock and Ossoff they got their base out and they went to the middle and got independent voters, right, in record numbers. And we got record numbers, but we ran a base-only campaign and ignored the suburbs. If we ran the Nathan Deal, Brian Kemp, Johnny Isaacson type of coalition building, we would have won in 2020. It was a bad strategic decision by the candidates and by their teams. And if we don't run base plus, the Democrats are going to win statewide in the next few cycles. However, the state is still slightly Republican by all data that we can look at objectively with a few independent voters. So, Jim, your numbers are right on. The votes are there in the suburbs, and we've got to find a way to win. And I'm concerned all three of the people we mentioned, Doug Collins, David Perdue, and Kelly Loeffler, they can win a Republican primary, but they're tragically flawed in winning a general election in 2022 in Georgia, in my opinion.
Heath, I'm going to ask you, I'm assuming that you're already deciding some of the people you'll represent in the 22 cycle. What kind of role, let's talk about it through the lens of Kelly Loeffler. One of the reasons that she's supported the Texas lawsuit, one of the reasons that she told Brad Raffensperger to resign because he wasn't willing to support Trump's challenge to the Georgia election is because she was beholden to Donald Trump. She saw winning the election tied to her support for Donald Trump. As you look at the 2022 cycle, what are you going to say to your clients about how they have to be thinking about Donald Trump and whether they align with him in 2022? And what should a Kelly Loeffler be thinking about in that regard?
Well, and listen, you know, obviously, if I'm talking to my clients in Alabama or Tennessee versus Georgia, it's different advice. But in Georgia, absolutely, they're going to have to run campaigns more like my former boss, Johnny Isaacson, and Nathan Deal and Brian Kemp. You've got to have a bigger, broader coalition in order to win. And you can't be 100% in a bear hug with Donald Trump in every single thing, every way that he campaigns. You're not Donald Trump, number one. Only Donald Trump's Donald Trump. You got to be able to call balls and strikes on that. You got to support the policies, right, that Trump borrowed from Ronald Reagan and from George W. Bush and others, you know, and it's going to be tough for some of them. But I do think even in the Republican primary in Georgia statewide, you don't have to do what David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler did in being all Trump all the time, both in personality and in policy.
All right. Thank you for that. We got to get to our final break of the show. We'll be back with more on Political Rewind. A quick program note before we continue with our panel today. Tomorrow, February 23rd, is the one-year anniversary of the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery. Travis and Gregory McMichael are still waiting to stand trial in the shooting death of Arbery. And so on the show, we're going to take a look at several aspects of that case. One, where does it stand today? What exactly is happening with the prosecution and the defense down there in Brunswick? But in a broader way, what's happening to the search for racial justice for dealing with systemic racism in this country that suddenly became a front burner issue as a result of the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and others? So that's going to be a special edition of our show tomorrow, and I hope you'll join us. I'm very much looking forward to that one. Sam Park, I haven't asked you this in advance, so I'm sort of, you know, it's like you go to trial and a lawyer's never supposed to ask a witness a question she or he doesn't know the answer to. But what are your constituents telling you about opening schools across Gwinnett? Are parents really right now up in arms about what the heck they want to happen with their kids?
So, of course, Gwinnett has the largest school system in the state of Georgia. We teach 1 in 10 students. It is a very complex issue that is not black and white. You know, parents of children with special needs that need that in-person learning, you know, they have very legitimate concerns. The concerns of teachers and their safety, especially given their inability to get vaccinated first. Also very legitimate concerns, but also a very complex issue. My hope is that hopefully as we see a sustained decline in cases and an increase in vaccine distribution, we will get to a spot come hopefully the beginning of the fall semester this year in which we can resume, hopefully if everything goes well, in-person teaching.
Riley, teachers really believe that they need to be jumped up in the line so they can be vaccinated. But the CDC says that classes, especially for lower grades, schools should be able to meet again without concern about teachers being vaccinated or not. And yet, this is a big issue in the state of Georgia. Teachers groups are saying, give us the vaccine, we're exposed.
Absolutely. And I think this is an issue that has evolved as well over time tremendously. You know, in the beginning, there was a lot of pushback for opening schools. Lots of schools had to open and then close down again. And now we have the CDC saying it's okay in certain to come back in certain environments, you know. But teachers want to come back. I think that's something so important to mention. You know, they want to do their jobs. They want to be teaching, but it's hard for them to feel safe because, you know, the students might not be at high risk, but they still are.
Jim, you have a personal connection to this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've got a high school teacher daughter. And the data shows that once you're, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds, you spread that just like an adult. And, you know, the fear is that there are two fears here Georgia high school teachers, I think. And number one is we've got 180 some odd school systems, and they all have different protocols. And there are some districts, especially out in rural Georgia and elsewhere, where there is no mask mandate. And that and teachers feel highly, highly vulnerable. I'd point you to Elbert County. Where they made that decision to give teachers early vaccination. I think they've settled that feud a little bit now. But and then the other part is that, of course, you've got the one thing that that doesn't happen in most elementary schools. You've got an athletic system where schools are competing one on one, body on body with people from other school districts, and that's just a natural mode of contracting and spreading the virus.
Heath, up in your part of the state, up there in Cobb County, you've had at least three that I can think of deaths of teachers to COVID-19, which is a terribly sad state of affairs. I guess Eric Tanenblatt, your Republican friend, on the show last week kind of pushed back at me when I said, what are the political implications of not vaccinating teachers in terms of the next election cycle? Is Governor Kemp going to face some opposition from teachers for not jumping them up? He thought it was terribly inappropriate. I would turn it into a political question, but let's face it, it is a political question as well as a public health issue.
Yeah, unfortunately, this whole battle has become political like everything in modern society. There's just a world of data now out there about K through 12 high schools. I have an 11-year-old, a 15-year-old, an 18-year-old. They've been in school full time since September of last year. The schools are following the proper protocols. They're doing contact tracing. It's just like Dr. Fauci has said, let's follow the science here. We've heard that for a lot for the last year. So there's no question that everybody K through 8 ought to be back in school, and the schools ought to be following the proper protocols with or without vaccines. If you're a teacher with compromised immune, there are accommodations for that. And then there's a legitimate debate around high school, like Jim has brought up. But there again, if you follow the proper protocols, just like every other part of society, you can protect those teachers from those students. And it's very clear that the schools that are back in are not having, even the high schools are not having the level of transmission that people fear of. My children play three sports, high school basketball, down underneath. There was no transmission on any of the teams. They played the entire season. So I think we need to follow the data and try to depoliticize this as best we can. And I'm really concerned. We say that we're concerned about the children that are falling farther behind, but good gracious, those that haven't been in school for a year, that's a gap year that we're going to be suffering the consequences of for decades now. And we've got to find a way to get these children back in school full time.
Yeah, I've got to say my heart goes out to parents like you, Heath, who have dealt with this, and I'm glad to hear your children have thrived despite the virus. So my heart does go out, and I must admit I'm glad my children have now moved beyond their high school years and college years even, and I'm not dealing with this issue personally as so many thousands of families across the state are. Jim, we've only got a couple minutes left, but one of the longest lasting wars that Georgia has fought has been between mostly Florida and Georgia now, but it used to be the Florida-Alabama-Georgia water wars over water coming out of the Chattahoochee River and who is going to get access to it. The Supreme Court of the United States, here's a case now between the oystermen of Florida and Georgians, especially along the Flint River down in southwest Georgia, farmers who want water, oystermen who want water, and this case finally gets to the Supreme Court today.
Right, and it's built around an oyster bed, a very famous oyster bed in Apalachicola Bay, I think. And the question is, you know, the Florida says Metro Atlanta is sucking up too much water, and that's increasing salinity in the bay. But the counter argument from Georgia is that these oyster beds have been over harvested. That's one reason for the decline, and then there's global warming.
Sam, we've got just a couple of minutes, but we should also point out that this also has an impact on some of the water supply for people right here in Metro Atlanta, as well as the people who listen to us across the southwest corner of the state.
Yeah, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I recall some study or report in which the Metro Atlanta area, despite the boom in population we've seen over the past decade, was using its water in a sustainable manner. In a wise way, despite the population growth that we've seen. And so, you know, if you want to foster some bipartisanship, I think you'll find a lot of support amongst Democrats and Republicans in Georgia on this issue, and that, you know, we're doing everything we can to conserve and properly use the water that we receive.
All right. It's a huge issue, and it just points us to the fact that in the years to come, water in this region is going to be a bigger and bigger matter for political leaders to try to figure out how to deal with. We're completely out of time for today's show. Representative Sam Park, Riley Bunch, Heath Garrett, Jim Galloway, thank you for a really interesting conversation today. We're back again tomorrow to talk about the year since Ahmaud Arbery's shooting death, and I hope you'll all join us for that conversation. My thanks to Jesse Neiswanger and Amelia Brock for their work on the show today. Sam Burmistawes has a day off, but he's back with us tomorrow, thank goodness. We're back tomorrow as well. And in the meantime, take care, stay healthy, wear a mask or maybe two. See y'all tomorrow.